You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SevillePodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. Albemarle County Chief of Police Steve Sellers and City of Charlottesville Chief of Police Timothy Longo gave a comprehensive presentation addressing the multifaceted issues of crime, crime prevention, and law enforcement in both the city and the county. Chief Sellers and Longo spoke at the Wednesday, January 11, 2012 meeting of the Senior Statesman of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV board member Jim Perkins.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Senior Statesman of Virginia, our first program in January. Happy New Year, everybody. I want to introduce Margaret Fitch, who's representing our host, the Senior Center, who has a few words before we get started. Margaret.
Thank you, Jim. I'm Margaret Fitch, and most of you know me. I'm the program coordinator here at the Senior Center. Again, I would like to say how much the Senior Center enjoys and appreciates our partnership with the Senior Statesmen of Virginia who bring these monthly meetings here to the Center. I'd also like to offer a personal welcome to our guests today, Chief Longo and Chief Sellers. It's okay. We do get to have a moment here every once in a while. It's okay. We'd like to welcome you to our award-winning, multidimensional Senior Center. We are a private organization. We receive no grants. We're supported solely by donation. If you are a guest here today, we would love to have you sign our guest book so we know who you are, and we welcome you back. And again, thank you so much for being here, and thank you, Senior Statesman, for holding this great, great venue.
Thank you again. Welcome on behalf of the Senior Statesman of Virginia and for our members. Welcome back for our guests. Remind you that we are a nonprofit organization and we seek your active support through your membership, which goes to pay for our newsletters put out by Jim Peterson and the group. And we would welcome having you join us as membership and bring other fellows and members to any of our meetings as they're open to the public and free. This afternoon, we're really fortunate in having two of the premier policemen in the area. I want to first introduce my friend Tim Longo, who's the chief of police of the city of Charlottesville, who is always wandering around, but he's doing his job. Tim has been with the city of Charlottesville since 2001, and he's a 25-year veteran of the law enforcement and is nationally recognized in the area of police ethics and professional standards. And he holds a law degree from the University of Baltimore and was admitted to the Maryland Bar in 1993. From 1981 to 2000, Tim has served on the Baltimore Police Force. Tim Longo lectures across America in the fields of ethics, professional standards, internal affairs, and a variety of legal topics. And he is a guest lecturer at the University of Virginia at the Schools of Law and Business. In Charlottesville, Chief Longo has guided the police department through a transition from a traditional reactive force to a proactive problem-solving model. And under his leadership, the department has instituted a comprehensive strategic plan of community policing throughout the organization and has undertaken major initiatives to improve police effectiveness, transparency, and accountability. And we've all seen the improvements in the department under his leadership. Longo serves on the boards of many Virginia Commonwealth associations, including the Virginia Association of Chiefs of Police and the Virginia Center for Policing Innovation, and he chairs the Thomas Jefferson Area Community Criminal Justice Board. So please welcome Tim Longo. With him today is Steve Sellers, who is the Chief of Police, County of Albemarle. He's a 29-year police veteran in Virginia and was appointed as the Chief of Police for Albemarle County in January 2011. So he's just finishing his one-year anniversary with us. Sellers holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in Business Administration and a Master's degree in Public Administration from Virginia Tech. Additionally, he is a graduate from the FBI National Academy. Shortly after the events of September 11, 2001, Chief Sellers developed a plan to improve criminal intelligence and information sharing between local, state, and federal law enforcement and helped to create the Northern Virginia Regional Intelligence Center, which is staffed by local, state, and federal agencies. The center is now heralded as a national model for the sharing, collection, and investigation of criminal intelligence. You may recall that in 2003, Chief Sellers led the Washington Area Sniper Prosecution Task Force. This is the task force that was responsible for the successful prosecution of Lee Malvo and John Muhammad. And in coordination with his counterparts in Prince William County Police Department, his role was to lead the 26-agency team responsible for investigation and prosecution of the Washington area snipers. So please welcome Chief Sellers. These gentlemen are going to make their presentation, starting with Chief Sellers. If we have time, as you know, our policy is to quit right at 3 o'clock. And time permitting, we will have our usual question and answer session, and I'll go over it with you at that time. Chief Sellers?
Both Chief Longo and myself like to work the room a little bit as we talk. That comes from his abilities to teach others, getting out into the student body and getting them to think. And I like to do the same thing. I'm not a speaker, an eloquent speaker like he is, but I do want to talk. We're going to start off talking a little bit about providing an update on crime in Albemarle County. The 2011 data is now in. I'm still sifting through it, so this is the first time anybody's had the opportunity to see this or hear this. I haven't gotten into the details yet, and I haven't double-checked the numbers, so don't hold me to those exact numbers, okay? How many people in the room live in Albemarle County? Wow. How many people live in Charlottesville? Okay. All right. Great mix. Great mix. Great community. I love being here. So let's talk about crime in Albemarle County. But before we do that, I always like to throw a couple of trivia questions out. Out of all, in the state of Virginia, there are so many jurisdictions that have a county police department. Can anybody raise their hand and provide me a reason why counties choose to create a police department and as their primary law enforcement function in lieu of the sheriff's departments? Anybody want to take a stab at that? In the back, sir, could you tell me your name? That's right. That's right.
Is that the reason? Oh, I'm sorry.
Let me repeat the question, okay? In the state of Virginia, counties either have a sheriff's department that fulfills their total law enforcement function, or they choose to create their own police department.
Population factor?
That is one factor. What else? Okay, sort of the level of law enforcement. You want a higher level of law enforcement. There was one other answer.
Yeah, I think the sheriff's department serves the courts, and the police do law enforcement on a much broader perspective.
Okay. Let me wrap up that trivia question for a minute, okay? There are a lot of counties in Virginia, a lot of counties. There are not a lot of county police departments. Those who raised their hand that live in Albemarle County, you selected to create a police department probably for two reasons. To get the politics out of law enforcement, that's probably one reason, right? Okay. And like this lady said right here, what's your name, ma'am?
Pat.
Pat. Like she said, maybe a higher level of police service. You want a higher level of police service. You want more dedicated police services in your county. So here I am. Next quiz question. And don't answer this, okay? Because I know you know the answer. How many counties in the state of Virginia have a county police department? Just throw out a number.
One.
No. Good guess, though. It's higher than that.
Three.
Three higher. 15 lower.
10.
I'm going to go with 10, but it's 9. That's the closest one. Congratulations. There are 9 counties in the state that have police departments. Okay? That's just my trivia question just to get us thinking and get us off. Okay? Let's get back to crime for a minute. Well, but one more trivia question. I got to have one more. How many cops do you think I have on the road right now covering Alamar County, 726 square miles? I heard 9 and I heard 11. It's probably somewhere in that mixed. Okay, it's probably somewhere between 9 and 11, covering the entire county. Okay? Large county, fifth largest county in the state. The good news is on crime, real good news on crime is it continues to decline. Overall, our serious Part 1 offenses, those are the most serious types of crime, are down 10% from last year. That is phenomenal. See, I've been here a year and they're down 10%. What's the correlation there? We like to take credit for that, don't we? We actually can't take credit for that, but we like to, okay? If it was up 10%, I would come up with some excuse on why crime is rising, and it wouldn't be me. But that's good news. That's good news for you who travel the county and for the many people who live in the county. Those are some graphs of the various crimes against persons, murder, rape, aggravated assault, robbery. That just shows the trend over the last, since 2005. I won't spend a lot of time on that because I want to focus on some other crimes that we're seeing some trends on. This is also just kind of a comparison over time. And again, I'm going to whiz right through that because I want to focus on a couple things that we're seeing in the county that are changing over time. Our robberies are up slightly, okay, in Alamar County in 2011. This is a disturbing crime that we're seeing an increase on, actually a substantial increase. Sexual assault crimes against children aged 13 to 17 are on the rise consistently in Alamar County since 2009. I don't know why that is. We have to get behind that data and look. It may be reporting is much better than it used to be, mandatory reporting of sexual assaults of children. That may be the reasons for the rise, but it's been consistent since 2009. I bring that to your attention. Gang crime, I have to be totally honest, I don't think Alamar County Police Department quite yet tracks gang crimes as efficiently as it could in the future. I don't know how the city does. We'll talk a little bit about gangs here shortly. But we're seeing generally a rise in gang activity, certainly a rise in the number of children that have been identified and validated as gang members. It's increasing. It's something that we have to pay attention to, and it's something we're working very closely together on trying to get behind. The next topic I want to talk to you about, Alamar County, has to do with traffic. Traffic safety is a serious, serious problem in Alamar County. Alamar County is a dangerous place to drive. Okay? So let's do a trivia question again, okay? Let's get you involved. Where are most of the most serious accidents occurring in Alamar County? A, the rural areas of the county, or B, the urban areas of the county? Someone want to take a stab at that? Sir?
Urban areas that have the cameras that can be a lot more good.
Is that you, Mr. Drago? Okay. Wrong. Wrong. But thanks for the guess, sir. You're dead on, and I don't use a word. I use the word dead for a reason, because we've had 20 fatal crashes in Alamar County in 2011. Absolutely unacceptable. Unacceptable. We don't need to be that way. Now, we mentioned earlier how many county police departments are in the state, and we came up with the number 9. So if we were to look at the other 9 of the other 8 county police departments, Alamar County is the most dangerous place to drive out of all those jurisdictions. This is just a map that the state puts together. I'll have to explain it just real briefly. They're color-coded, okay, and the dark, almost black-looking areas are the most fatalities, where the most fatalities occur in the state. Last year, Alamar County is right here in the middle, and you can see it's not a good place to drive. Okay, so what are the causations? We know they're in the rural areas, okay, and we know some of the reasons behind the accidents. We talked about speed. You talked about speed, sir. That is one of the 3 most frequent causations of our serious accidents in the county. What's another hint, if anybody can read that? That's right. Lack of a seatbelt. Not using your seatbelt. That's right. Thank you. Not using your seatbelt. That's right. Again, the most accidents that occurred without seatbelt usage are in the red. Alamar County is right there. Okay. excuse me. This is a comparison of the 9 county police departments from 2008 through 2010 with an overlay for 2011. And you'll notice, at least until 2011, we're up there in terms of the highest number of fatalities. Okay. We have surpassed Prince George County. Their numbers are a little bit skewed. Does anybody know where Prince George County, Virginia is? Ma'am? No, that's not. That's a good guess, but that's where Prince George's County, Maryland is. It's over toward Petersburg, and 95 goes through it. Okay. And so their numbers are a little skewed because they've had some bad commuter van and bus accidents there where the numbers were driven up. We are the most dangerous right now of all these counties. And these are injury accidents. These are only injuries, not fatalities. And you can see we're also right up there in one of the most dangerous places to drive. Okay. I show this to you. This is a map of the county. There's the magisterial districts around there. This is the city of Charlottesville right here in this white area. Those dots represent GPS coordinates in a typical 24-hour period of my police officers, okay? So that's a 24-hour period. That's where my police officers are. I call it getting sucked into the vortex. They get sucked into the urban ring because that's where the calls for service occur. Okay, you'll notice, where did we say most of these serious accidents are occurring? In the rural area. There's nobody in the rural area, hardly at all. And that's where these things are happening. And I bring that to your attention. I've gone to the state police, I've met with the local division commander for assistance in helping us patrol our rural roads a little bit better. Tim, I'm going to pass it over to you.
Jim, you going to switch out the PowerPoint for me? Hi, everyone. While Jim Peterson's switching out my PowerPoint, I was asked by one of the media folks when I came in, what was it that I expected to get out of this today? I don't know. What do you expect to get out of it? And I said to him, I don't know what's coming in the room. I mean, I don't know the people that show up, but do they know me? Do they know our police department? I just don't know. So I want to spend a couple minutes talking about our police department, kind of explain to you how the department's organized, what our budget is, and then get into some specifics. And then Steve and I are going to team back up again and talk about collaboration. I go all over the country and deal with other police agencies and run my mouth a lot, sometimes just to hear myself talk. And I tell people, and I mean this seriously, I was very impressed when I moved my family here 11 years ago that we live in a community where there aren't any fences, where, you know, it's the Robert Frost poem that good fences make good neighbors. Well, we don't believe that here. And the police department surely don't believe it here. We collaborate every day on law enforcement issues around this region. And it's not just Albemarle and Charlottesville. It's the University of Virginia and all the other counties that surround us. So when Steve and I get back together and speak in a more collaborative sense in a couple minutes, we'll talk about some of the things we're doing together. But I wanted to start by introducing you to our police department. For those of you who don't know anything about the city of Charlottesville Police Department, that fellow up there is me with black hair. That was 11 years ago. When I got here, and the hair's not black anymore, but that's no one's fault but my own, and of course our beautiful downtown pedestrian mall. Every organization has a mission, and whether it's a police organization or the private sector, and our mission's pretty simple, and I'm going to break it down in simple terms. My job is to make your life better. Whether you live in Charlottesville, whether you work in Charlottesville, whether you come to Charlottesville to visit, it's to create and sustain an environment where you'll be safe and where you'll be happy and where you'll feel protected. We talk a lot about crime numbers. Those numbers probably don't mean much to most people. What means something is if they can actually come downtown and feel like they're safe. I can throw all kind of numbers at you to try to convince you that you're safe. If you don't feel that way, all the numbers in the world aren't going to change your mind. So our mission every day and everything that we do is to create and sustain a safe environment for you, whether you live, work, or visit the city of Charlottesville. When I was hired 11 years ago, it was made very clear to me that the mission was to transform a traditional police agency, which did a good job at responding to calls and investigating crime and clearing incidents, to a proactive community policing model. And the huge difference with that is one, the strategies are collaborative. That means it includes your input. You get a chance to say how you want your city policed. The other thing that's important about community policing is it requires two other things. One is trust, which is sometimes hard to win back if you've lost it. And then secondly, relationships. So that no matter where I go in the city, there's someone I can reach out to whom I have a relationship with to help deal with the issues to confront our community. So my job was to create a community policing environment. And it really is about four things. It's about, one, creating the partnership and then agreeing to accomplish four very important missions. Number one is to arrest problems. You notice I didn't say arrest people. Sometimes arresting problems means arresting people, but not all the time. It means identifying what the problem is and making it stop. And sometimes that's hard, because in traditional policing, we've spent a lot of time treating symptoms and not causes. So once we've identified the problem, it's developed strategies to make the problem stop. Second is to reduce crime and the fear of crime. Third is to, whatever strategy we put in place, solve the problem. Don't put a Band-Aid on a sucking chest wound. Solve the problem. It's more expensive to do it that way. It takes more resources to do it that way, but it's far more effective because it's sustainable over time. I'll give you an analogy. You call me tonight and you say, Chief Longo, I've moved into the city, and on my corner are drug dealers, and they're there every night. Make them go away. I'll saturate your neighborhood with cops. We'll serve every arrest warrant to be served there. We'll execute search warrants. You'll see police cars up and down your street. We'll stop cars. We'll give out tickets. We will be highly visible in your community. Guess what will happen? The drug dealers will leave and they'll go to the county. Right? It's called spatial displacement. It doesn't work. It's not effective policing. And the other reason why it's not good is I don't have the numbers to be able to sustain that over long periods of time. I'm a finite resource of 117 sworn police officers. Once we've done the first three things, arrest the problem, reduce crime and fear of crime, and solve the problem, The fourth thing is the natural byproduct, and that is we create a safe environment and improve the quality of life for the city of Charlottesville and its residents. When we came here, when I came here 11 years ago and developed a strategic plan for the police department, five operational goals. Number one was to reduce open-air drug markets and gun violence because it was driving the violent crime in this city. I think we've done a pretty good job of that, getting drug dealers off of street corners. Now, we haven't got all of them off every street corner. That's a work in progress. And the Jefferson Area Drug Enforcement Task Force, of which we are both part of, doing a very exceptional job of trying to accomplish a really important message. But goal number one is to reduce drug and gun violence. If we can do that, we'll drop the violent crime numbers in our community. That's the top priority. The second is to reduce participation in criminal street gangs. It was about 2002 or 2003 when we became very open with the fact that there are gangs in Charlottesville, and we sought to criminally prosecute those people. Steve and I, as we'll talk about in a couple minutes, have collaborated on a way to do that in a more regional way, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. The third operational goal is to sustain a safe and healthy community across the city, not just in certain parts of the city where the crime rate might have been higher, but in every neighborhood within the 10.7 square miles of the city of Charlottesville. The fourth operational goal was to create positive opportunities for mentoring with young people. How do we do that most effectively? By keeping cops in schools, by keeping school resource officers in the high school, in the middle school, in the upper elementary school, and even touching the five or six elementary schools across the city. And then lastly, to strengthen public trust. I can't do any of these things, nor can I run a police department, generally speaking, unless I have the trust of the community. It's not going to be 100%. Nothing's 100%. I can't win the hearts and minds of 100% of the people. But if I can get the vast majority of the people to trust what we're doing and trust in the integrity of the department, we can make progress. Very quickly, operating budget's $13.4 million. That'll probably go up 2, 3, 4% this year as we present our new budget. That's what it costs to run this police department. The vast majority of that money goes into personnel and benefits. The department's broken down into three groups. The Field Operations Division, which is the uniform division of the department. Its component parts are the K-9 team, the SWAT team, the crisis negotiation team, bike patrol officers, foot beats, the telephone reporting unit, and the evidence technicians that are staff across the patrol bureau. The second is the Support Services Division. Most of you would know them as the detectives. The various component parts of that division are the General Investigations Bureau. There's about 12 detectives in the General Investigations Bureau. The Neighborhood Services Bureau, which includes our school resource officers, our crime prevention teams, also our traffic enforcement unit. The forensic unit, we have, I'm happy to say, in our region, one of the most progressive forensic units in the Commonwealth of Virginia, if not across the state. Several of the members of that unit are graduates of the Virginia Forensic Academy, and we just recently graduated our first from Knoxville, Tennessee, the University of Tennessee's National Forensic Academy, Officer Eric Pendleton. And then, of course, one of the units that Steve and I collaborate in, the Jefferson Area Drug Enforcement Unit, which consists of the City of Charlottesville, the County of Albemarle, the Virginia State Police, and the Drug Enforcement Administration. The third component part of the department is the Administrative Services Bureau. That is just about everything that's behind the scenes that you may never interact with if you have any interaction at all with the police department. That's our Information and Management Services Division. They staff our NCIC, which is National Crime Information Center computer, and a Virginia Crime Information Network computer system. They house our warrants. They run our criminal history. They do all our administrative support for both patrol and investigations. The Staff Development and Accreditation Unit, the City of Charlottesville and the County of Albemarle, is one of about 40-some-odd police agencies in the Commonwealth of Virginia that are accredited by the Virginia Association of Law Enforcement Professional Standards. We also are Internal Affairs Unit. We have a dedicated detective sergeant that investigates citizen complaints. We have a technical investigative support unit that takes care of all our audiovisual equipment that we use during the course of our investigations, all our in-car camera equipment. Our crime analyst by the name of Kristen O'Connell that provides all the crime information to individuals who request crime data on neighborhoods and streets and locations. She's also responsible for compiling our annual report, which will be on our website, our 2011 annual report, in the next couple weeks. And then, of course, we're a business, so we got to pay bills, we got to generate a payroll. So we have an accounts payable and receivable section as well, and a quartermaster unit. All that is done within the Administrative Services Bureau. How do we accomplish low crime numbers? How does Steve accomplish what he's accomplished with respect to crime reductions? How do we accomplish what we've accomplished with respect to crime reductions? By taking a focused look on crime. This model that I believe we both use, CompStat, was developed by Dr. Phyllis McDonald when she worked for Bill Bratton in the New York Transit Authority Police Department. It's using technology to drive resources. Accurate and timely information and technology to deploy resources to deal with specific issues. And this model, which has been mirrored across the nation, brings police departments, every component part of a police department, into the same room to talk about crime and quality of life issues in the community, and to talk very specifically about the strategies that will be used to deal with those issues. This model, we do it once a month. Some departments do it once a week. But our numbers are low enough that we can do it once a month and be very effective. Problem-solving projects are another strategy we use, where we've actually told every police officer who works in their 10 police work areas or districts throughout the city, and each one of those 10, or 8 rather, are staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So there's a police officer responsible for that real estate. And he or she is also responsible for identifying the problems in that community, which may be crime problems, they may be other kind of problems. Identifying what those problems are and helping to work with citizens and other resources in the department to develop what we call problem-solving strategies, and then we track that over time to see how successful the officers are in going about their work. Just like Steve showed you, these are called trend line maps. You can see over the past 5 years how violent crime numbers have dropped in the city. And these are property crime numbers, and they too have dropped pretty significantly over the last 5 years. A couple of recent training initiatives I want to tell you about, and then Steve and I are going to talk about some of the things we do together. And I'm going to just briefly touch on CIT. You'll notice that both of our uniforms were wearing badges that say CIT. That stands for Crisis Intervention Team. As far as I know, we're the only two police chiefs in the Commonwealth of Virginia that have went through this 40-hour block of instruction with about 70% plus of our patrol force. What this training has enabled us to do is to be able to deal with people that are suffering from mental illness or an emotional crisis, and to be able to de-escalate the situation that they found themselves in, get them to the appropriate service provider so that it's not the Avon Street Hilton, the regional jail, and to also, and most successfully, reduce the tension of the situation so that force isn't necessary. And we've been very effective at doing that here in Charlottesville, Albemarle, and our program here has actually become a model for around the state. We also have a relationship with the Center for the Constitution in Montpelier, where I serve on the adjunct staff. We help develop, and we present once or twice a year a constitutional seminar, if you will, for police officers to improve their constitutional literacy. And that's one of the things that we've been able to bring to our region, both as Steve and I have sent officers to that program. And while at the end of the day, they're not constitutional scholars, they're certainly constitutional practitioners, and that's the purpose of the program. The other thing that we've done just recently that I'm very proud of, are you all familiar with the Rutherford Institute here in Charlottesville? John Whitehead, John is a personal friend, a good man. He and I spoke on the radio together on drug legalization the other day. You can imagine we were maybe on different sides on some of the issues, but nonetheless, we agree on a lot of things, believe it or not. And one of the things we agree on, and this touches on the issue that we might talk about in discussions, and that's the Occupy movement, and the importance of making sure police officers understand the Constitution, making sure that police officers understand what the First Amendment says, and that part of our job is to protect and preserve those rights. Because when police officers are put in situations that are very different than they've been in many years, it's very important that they understand the constitutional application to their job. And so John and I and his students there at the Rutherford Center have put together a teaching aid for police officers that will be pushed out to the Commonwealth of Virginia and hopefully throughout the country on First Amendment literacy and law enforcement. And then lastly, some training we've done just recently with Professor Brandon Garrett, who is an expert. He's a university law professor, University of Virginia School of Law professor. He's been cited by the United States Supreme Court in almost all the 11th circuits on his knowledge with respect to wrongful convictions and identifications. Brandon, just as recent as yesterday, presented a training piece to every one of our detectives and our key patrol supervisors on eyewitness identifications and how to conduct our criminal investigative work in ways that will withstand constitutional scrutiny. So there's some of the recent training initiatives that we've undertaken in the department. Now what I'd like to do is we'll turn it back over to Steve and I. We'll talk about some of the collaboratives that we do across jurisdictional lines, and then begin to take some of your questions and have a discussion with the larger room. Is that okay with you?
Okay, we said we would talk about the G word, and we're going to talk about the G word a little bit. Tim and I have been talking about the G word a lot lately. And as I mentioned before in the crime report, gangs are on the increase in Elmore County and the region, in Charlottesville, and the surrounding jurisdictions. That concerns us, okay? As your chief law enforcement officials, that concerns us. We think we are doing the best job that we can on the enforcement side. Would that be?
I think so. I mean, I think it's safe to say from an enforcement and intelligence gathering perspective, we've done as good a job as we can in trying to get our arms around this problem. But the fact of the matter is, it's getting to the point where it just can't be a law enforcement problem. It's got to be a problem that the community's willing to take on. It's got to be a problem that the educators are willing to take on. If I can make a statement, Steve and I were together on a panel that the Healthy Schools Program hosted about gangs about a month ago. Mm-hmm. And I started my brief remarks of about 5 minutes with the statement that, you know, this isn't a comfortable word. It's not a comfortable topic. It's not comfortable for politicians to talk about. It's not comfortable for educators to talk about. It's not comfortable for people who are concerned about economic development to talk about. I mean, it's a difficult situation, but it's a topic we have to talk about nonetheless, because it affects the safety and well-being of our community.
That's right. That's right. And it's on the increase. Our line level police officers are seeing more and more gang presence in this area, and we need to get in front of it. And we're doing about everything that we can at this point except for that piece. If you were to imagine the gang issue as a pie chart, okay, as a pie chart, Tim and I own a little sliver of that, very small piece of it. That's the enforcement and intelligence piece of it, okay? The community as a whole, whether it's faith-based, schools, churches, activity centers for youth, youth programs, Boy Scouts, YMCA, you name it, social services, human services, they own the rest of that piece of pie. And sort of our goal is, I think our goal is, and it's articulated on that slide behind me, is to do a collaborative, coordinated effort to bring all the players to the table to own that piece of pie and to help us do our jobs, and we can help them do their jobs.
You know, part of the problem is we've waited too long, as we have in many issues that we face as a society. We've waited too long to, one, acknowledge the existence and presence of the problem, and then to gear up to begin to deal with it. The drug issue is a classic example. The war on drugs started 40 years ago, yet the illegal importation of opiates into this country happened long before that. But it took the country a long time to recognize we have a public health problem surrounding drugs, and we need to begin to deal with it. That's a whole other topic. Set that aside. Same issue with the gang problem. We've taken too long to publicly acknowledge this is a problem, and we need to get our arms around it. And we can't wait to the young men and women get in high school and begin to confront the issue. I worked with a gentleman several years ago who used to tell our community back in Baltimore, a kid makes a gun, no gun decision by the time that they're 10. If you're not having discussions with them about that level of violence, by that point, you've missed the window of opportunity. So part of what I hope we're able to accomplish in developing this collaborative is to really convince educators we need to be in the elementary schools having age-appropriate discussions about gang activity. We need to have a connection in the upper elementary and the middle schools to have age-appropriate discussions about gang activity. We can no longer wait till they're in high school, and we can no longer wait till they're standing in front of a juvenile and domestic relations court judge having been charged with a crime. Because at that point, it's almost too late.
That's right. So most of the effort that we're working toward is to get in front of the problem, not behind it. We have the behind the problem job. We want to get in front of it. And so, our proposal or what we're trying to accomplish is to seek some federal funding, hopefully through a grant at some point. Perhaps seek a multidisciplinary coordinator, gang coordinator, for the region. Remember what Tim said about there are no fences? There's certainly no fences for gangs. And we work with our neighboring jurisdictions well beyond Charlottesville. And we have to take a regional, multidisciplinary approach to the gang issue. If we don't, it'll fail. Or if we don't take a regional approach, it will result in geospatial displacement. What did you call that? Displacement?
Spatial displacement.
Okay. Right. It'll result in displacement. And we're already seeing that. Okay. So we've got a lot to do. We've got meetings scheduled, I think, as early as next week to begin to get our handle around developing the plan and to beginning the next steps of this process and getting everybody to the table.
Just to kind of reiterate the valuable resources we have in this community, there was a newspaper article in the Daily Progress, 3 months ago, that the reporter spoke to Steve and I about this issue, and she wrote a nice piece about it. And the next day, Gwen Mason from the United States Attorney's Office contacted Steve and I by email. Her boss, the Honorable Timothy Hafey, who is our U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Virginia, a dear friend to law enforcement, and also a resident of the city of Charlottesville, tasked her with the responsibility of reaching out to us and seeing what his office can do to help with this problem. And there's a good reason for that, not only because he's a fine U.S. attorney, but he was the federal prosecutor that prosecuted one of this city's first racketeering trials, where we brought 20-some-odd gang members to federal court and federally prosecuted them for murder and drug conspiracies. And two of the major players in that federal trial are doing consecutive life sentences. Mr. Hafey prosecuted that. He is uniquely familiar with the problems we face in this community and wants to use the resources, I think, and I'm not speaking for Tim, but I know that he wants to make available the resources that he has at his disposal to help keep this community safe and to be a valuable resource to Chief Colonel Sellers and I and to our departments. So we're going to meet with Gwen next week and talk about, are there ways to seek federal funds, to get federal assistance, to do a good job at what it is we want to try to accomplish. And the first step of that will be a community forum where we'll be inviting stakeholders into the room to talk more about this problem, to hear from them what they see, what their perceptions or their realities may be with respect to gang activity in our community, and what the viable strategies are that they would like to see put in place, particularly when it comes to the prevention and the education side, which I think we both would agree the prevention piece is where we've been weak, and will continue to be weak without your help.
I would encourage anyone that has an interest in learning more about gangs is to stay connected to this issue as it develops in the local press and media and stay involved. Secondarily, if you need a presentation and you represent a particular group or club or unit, Chief Longo and I have two really good detectives that work closely together on gang issues, Detective Todd Lucas and Detective Jim Hope, who'd go out and do these community presentations upon request. So feel free to reach out to us to have that done. The best way that you can learn about it is to spend some time learning about it and engage in it. So anything else on gangs?
Well, the only thing I would mention, too, is so that you'll be comfortable is we can make the presentation as graphic and as honest as you want it to be. or we can make it as sensitive and as age-appropriate and as group-appropriate as you want it to be. We've been invited into churches after Sunday school to do presentations, and we've made sure that our presentation was such that it would not be offensive to people. We've been invited into to elementary and middle schools to do the presentation, and we've made it so that the presentation would not be offensive to the children or to their parents. So when you ask us to come present, let us know up front. I want to see the real deal, or hold back a little bit and just tell me the facts, because we can certainly do that, because we want to make sure that we give you information that's going to be useful to you.
Let's talk about training. In some of our observations, Tim and I, in terms of our existing training in the region and our existing training of our police officers, I'm going to go through this a little bit. You know, across the country, police departments' training budgets have been slashed, okay? And so we've had to become more creative in terms of how we do training. And in fact, we have to learn to collaborate more when it comes to training to keep those costs down. That's my police department that you see up there, and that's the number of hours of training they receive. I think that starts in 2006, and you can see the economy going downhill, can't you? Because that parallels my budget and my training budget. And you can see this last year we've bolstered training, and I have to be honest with you, the only reason I brought training, was able to bring training up from 6,000 to nearly 11,000 in a year's time, is because we do a lot of joint training together, okay? That keeps the cost down. And I brought in a lot of free training from my previous employer, Fairfax County Police, and they came down and brought in professionals. And some of my connections with the federal government, the FBI and the CIA and some other three-letter alphabets, to come down to Charlottesville and put training on for free. But that well is going to dry up eventually.
Might be helpful, too, because we're going to take the conversation to the next step and to talk about what Steve and I are forecasting as far as our training needs go down the road. But it might be helpful now to kind of give you a snapshot for how police officers in this region are currently trained and have been trained for the last many years. We are part of a regional academy system in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Most police and sheriff's departments and correctional facilities are trained in regional academies. Some of the larger departments either operate their own academies or they are a part of what's called independent academies. We're part of a regional academy. So when I send one of my officers to training over in Weir's Cave across that mountain, we're training with 57 other law enforcement agencies from around this region. Some of those are large police departments. We're the largest. Some of them are small sheriff's departments. And those two different types of police officers are getting the same 16 weeks of training. When we bring them back after 16 weeks, then we're running them to about a 12 or 13 week field training program where we're putting them with field training officers, putting them in a police car, and helping them apply what they've learned in that classroom in a real-world environment. That's the way we've been doing it for many years. And I think one of the things we agree upon is I think we can do better than that. I think we can equip police officers in Charlottesville and Albemarle better than that. Make no mistake, they're meeting state standards in that training. They're meeting minimum standards established by the Commonwealth of Virginia for law enforcement officers across the state. We want to have the opportunity to equip the officers in a much better way with more scenario-based training and kind of take that training to the next level. So as we're looking down over the next 2 years, we're trying to think of ways that we can collaborate and accomplish that in a way that's best for our department and then ultimately best for this community as a whole.
And so I think it's important also to pick up where Tim left off in terms of what you get. What you have, that red bar up there is the Albemarle County Police Department, Charlottesville Police Department, and UVA Police Department, and that is the number of training in weeks, basic training in weeks, that our officers receive. The next blue bar that's significantly taller than the red bar is the average training in weeks for independent Virginia police academies, okay? We're not even up to the average in terms of our basic training. You need to understand that. national average for basic training for law enforcement officers is 30 weeks, 16 to 18 weeks here, 30 weeks to the national average. We have to do something about that. And so we're doing that. We're working on a plan to get our officers better trained so that they provide better service to the community, so that they become excellent practitioners of the Constitution, so that they come out of the academy already crisis intervention trained, okay? That reduces the number of times we have to pull this weapon out and use it, or use of force. And then, so we can be better prepared as a community to address things. One of the things that I always worry about, and Tim, you can let me know whether you worry about this. I'm sure you do. I worry about a Virginia Tech incident happening at UVA, and all three agencies having to work together and respond. We'll do it, and we'll get it done, okay? But I know we can be better at it if we were in the same classroom developing our own curriculum that is consistent with the needs of the Charlottesville-Albemarle area.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think all too often in policing and in other aspects of life, we get complacent. We look at the fact that, you know, this is a relatively safe place. The quality of life in this community is much greater than many other places across the country. And we don't want to think that terrible things like what happened at Tech or what happened in other parts of America can happen here. But the fact of the matter is they can. The fact of the matter is they can happen anywhere. And as a citizen, I would want to believe that our police departments can stand up a contingent of resources sufficient enough to deal with whatever comes our way and have the technical competency and skills and ability to be able to perform in such a way to deal with that issue, to restore order, and to keep our community safe. And we work hard to make sure that our resources are, in fact, equipped to do that. But we do that outside of that 16-week curriculum. We do that when we bring them back here, and we work hard to bring that skill set up and to continue that skill set throughout the year with specialized training and within service training. Our model, what we would like to do in the years to come, is to be able to develop right here in our own community a sufficient way to be able to accomplish that together in the same classroom, in real time, and meeting that national average.
That's right. And so we're going to get there. We're going to get there over time, and we're taking baby steps along the way. And I'm looking forward to a bright future. We'll take it a step further, and we're even looking at and talking about a multidisciplinary approach to public safety training, and that's putting firefighters in some of the same classrooms and rescue workers in some of the same classrooms as our police officers when the topic overlaps. Topic overlaps with first aid training, CPR training. Topics overlap with SIT training. Topics overlap with incident command training on how you run an incident. So it's even larger than what we initially described, okay, more complex. Our first sort of baby step, I guess, toward that combined public safety academy is what you've been hearing on the news lately about the police shooting range, okay? Charlottesville and Albemarle have joined forces and shared resources on our capital improvement program to develop and construct a police shooting range. $133,000 was just recently appropriated by the Albemarle Board of Supervisors to begin the site work on that almost $1.1 million project. Talking about further collaborations, our two police foundations will be working together to fill any gaps that the budget won't cover on this police firing range, and that's coming soon.
One thing that might be worth mentioning, because the question is obviously comes up, is, well, what are you doing now? You mean you're not training with firearms now? How's that work? Well, we've been the guests of the very gracious Rivanna Pistol Club here in Albemarle County for many, many years. And they've been gracious hosts in allowing us to use that facility. But keep in mind, that's a private membership club. And it's gotten to the point that, you know, the amount of time that we're spending on that range may have taken away the time that private member gets to spend on that range. It just comes down to fundamental fairness in a business decision that they've had to make to say, chiefs, you know, we love you, but We're going to have to cut back on the availability a little bit because we're a private organization, and we respect that. By the same token, we have a legal mandate to make sure police officers are trained in areas where there's an obvious need to train them. And firearms proficiency, and use of deadly force are certainly areas where there's an obvious need to train. So this isn't an aspect of training that we can just kind of nonchalantly say, well, we'll kind of work through it, Steve. We really got to think sensibly about what's the long-term solution to meet the needs of the department. We could send officers all over the state to firearms facilities and train them, but there's a huge cost associated with that. And I'm not sure that that would be money well spent for our community, but that's what the public process is for. But we're hopeful that this will be something that will help us meet the needs of our departments and at the same time be that first step of city-county collaboration in a really important thing like a public safety training facility.
And we'll get to work out the bugs of our mutual agreements in this facility up front before we do create the larger entity, if you will. Exciting times. Just real quick also, what are the two most highest liability, you're an attorney, what's the two most highest liability that any local government takes on?
Well, there's 12 actually, 12.
I'm asking for the top two.
Okay, well, you're gonna lock me down, force and driving probably.
Right? That's right, use of force, deadly force and driving. And so this facility where we're building this police firing range also down the line has plans for a driver's training facility. So, let's see. That's a rendition of the police firing range in the sort of darker yellow color or greenish color. That's the phase one. That's what we're going to begin construction on in July. So, the larger area, kind of in the light yellow, is the future plan and design for the remainder of the construction of that that police range. And there's a little rendition of the driver's training track, which is kind of whited out a little bit in your representation on the board here. Okay.
I want to just step back a minute, and we glossed over the crisis intervention team model, and of course I explained it briefly when I was making my presentation to you. That model is about 25 years old, and it was developed in Memphis, Tennessee, and was implemented in that department and that community to meet the needs of the mental health community, and at the same time the needs of the police department. What we've chosen to do here in Charlottesville, Albemarle, that's a little different, is rather than make that CIT team, if you will, that unit, that squad, kind of a specialized group within the organization, we've made a commitment to the Commonwealth of Virginia, who had given us some grant funds over the years to do this, to implement this model, that each year we would increase the percentage of patrol personnel that have undergone this training. We're up to about 75%. What does that mean? It's more likely than not on any given shift at any given time when we're met with a situation where someone's in crisis, whether it be for mental health reasons or other reasons, when someone's in crisis, there will be people on that shift that will be directed to respond by the Emergency Communication Center, that 911 and dispatch, to go to that location and to deal with that crisis. Not only have police officers, both jurisdictions, been trained in this, the dispatchers at the 911 center have been trained in crisis intervention, the sheriff's departments have been trained in crisis intervention, the people at the Charlottesville Albemarle Regional Jail have been trained in crisis intervention, so that across the fields of law enforcement, any one of us who will touch that person in crisis have undergone that training. That's huge for this community.
Very big.
It's huge for any community. And I'll tell you why. There are certain types of individuals that are being killed in encounters with law enforcement officers these days. Alarming percentage of them are people in crisis, people who are mentally ill. What is most attractive about this program, from my perspective, is that it reduces the likelihood of using force. Bad situations escalate very quickly. We want to train our people, particularly when we're dealing with people in crisis, to ratchet it down, to have the skills to be able to de-escalate a situation so that force is not used. The other beauty and value that this program has brought to both of our departments is, used to be that when someone was in crisis and we had reason to believe, based on our observations, that person was an imminent threat to them or someone else, and they needed to be seen by a doctor, we would transport them to the University of Virginia, and the process of obtaining an emergency commitment order would begin. Sometimes a police officer would be sitting in the emergency room with that person for 4 hours. A police officer, particularly in Albemarle, where there's only 10 of them for 700 square miles at any given time, is sitting in a hospital emergency room. Now, not that they weren't doing important work, but they needed to be back out in the community doing what you pay them to do. What the University of Virginia Police Department has done to help with this program is not only train their officers and their security staff in crisis intervention. Chief Gibson has said, you know what? When they come to my emergency room, we got it. We've reduced that 4 hours to about 40 minutes, which is huge. And when I talk to other people around the state when we're trying to sell CIT because it works, that's one of the things that's most attractive to chiefs and sheriffs. You mean I can get these guys and gals back on the street in 40 minutes and the job gets done and people get help? It's a win-win situation for everybody. So this is a program that I think really is something we're extremely proud of as police chiefs, and that I think the community should be proud of as well, that we've really taken this situation on and have made it part of what we do every day.
Mm-hmm. Ready to take some questions?
I think so.
You think so?
Well, let me thank you gentlemen both. We have a couple of our board members who are going to come around with the microphones. Again, I repeat that we have the questions are being podcast, so we ask that you hold them until you get a microphone, and then we'll get to you as soon as possible. And we had the one gentleman back there.
I need to preface this before I ask the question. I read a story a few months ago about the signers of the Declaration of Independence. 56 men signed the Declaration, is my understanding. But the odd thing is that I didn't know is that not only did they sign it, but when they did, their families signed the Declaration as well, their wives, their sons, and their daughters. And the reason is the British hunted those 56 men and their families from pillar to post, field to farm, city to town, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Most of them lost all of their property, their farms, their houses. They were left destitute by the end of the Revolutionary War. Many of them had their children kidnapped by the British, never to be seen again. They never knew what their fate was. That was the commitment that those people had towards the birthing of a new nation conceived in liberty. In fact, a guy by the name of Clark, who signed from New Jersey, had two of his teenage sons fight in the Continental Army. They were captured by the Brits and put in the hellhole prison ship in Boston Harbor. The Brits told this guy, Clark, that if he would recant, he would take back his oath, that they would release his two sons, which he did not do. And they died a horrible, horrible death in that prison ship. You know what he said, Clark? He gave his sacred honor. Sacred honor. So here's my question to you, gentlemen. We see now that the TSA is everywhere. In fact, they're now at train stations. And I'm sure they'll be coming to Charlottesville in the not too distant future. It seems to be that now people will leave the train, they're departing the train, going home, and the TSA forces them to be frisked, to run their hands up and down their bodies to check them. Even though they're not boarding the train, they're leaving the train, as well as checking all of their baggage and goods they bring with them. Now, here's what I want to know. I don't fly anymore because I refuse to be sexually assaulted by TSA goons, so I do occasionally use the train. If I come back to Seaville and the TSA have set up shop, and I tell them, no, you're not going to do that, and if you touch me, that's assault and battery, and they do, and I call you, and your men in blue come, who will they side with, Chief? Will they side with me, who is sticking up for his constitutional rights? Will they side with me, who is saying that these non-police officers, by the way, as you know, TSC are not police, mm-hmm. have assaulted and battered me. Will I be arrested for, would your guys arrest me for unlawful or disorderly conduct?
Thank you. Let's let the police officers answer your question. I appreciate it.
Let me answer that in a couple ways. First and foremost, I'm going to assume that when the police get there, that no one is being disorderly, that you wish merely to make a police report. And if that police report is for assault and battery, they will take that. Now, because it was a misdemeanor that did not occur in their presence, they would not have probable cause to make an arrest of anyone. But they would, as they would in any other situation, advise you to go present yourself in front of the magistrate to seek a charging document or a warrant for assault and battery. That would be my expectation. Keeping in mind, though, if in fact they got there and TSA, who would be an agent of the property owner of that train depot, were saying this person has been asked to leave and he or she refuses to leave, we therefore deem them a trespasser, we want them removed from this property, then of course you would have to leave. Or you could be subject to either a citation or a custodial arrest. But assuming, based on your question, that that wasn't the case and you simply wish to report a crime, my expectation would be they would make a police report, as they would in any other situation, and refer you to the magistrate to seek a charging document. It would be up to the magistrate to determine whether or not that constituted assault and battery. Your avenue for redress would be to file a lawsuit under Section 1983 of Article 42 of the United States Code, seeking redress for a violation of clearly established constitutional rights. You would have a right to file a civil action as a citizen against the government in that case.
The first thing I want to do is to thank you to your very impressive leaders of the community in police enforcement and law and order.
Thank you, sir.
And I've known Chief Longo for a number of years, and I get more impressed every day. I have not known
you, sir.
But
that.
Anyway, my question has to do with guns, and it has to do with changing the hunting laws so you can shoot on Sundays, which is a problem for me because I like to go into the field and feel like I'm safe on Sunday and not going to get shot. The other thing has to do with a legislator in Northern Virginia who wants to change the law and require the University of Virginia to open up more to the presence of guns on the campus. And I'd like to know what can we do about that, or what do you all think about it?
You're up, buddy.
You want to touch that one?
You're up.
Well, didn't I say that?
I did my part.
counties create police departments to pull the politics out of law enforcement. Didn't I say that earlier? I don't have an opinion on the hunting law. Obviously, my officers spend very, very little time addressing hunting laws. We get a lot of complaints about hunting laws, okay? We get a lot of complaints about them. But typically, we refer them to the state. The state, recently, the state just provided a new game warden for the region here. And he works out of my station quite frequently. I don't know if I want to touch that one, honestly.
I'll say this. Because I got to say something. We'll talk about it at home. You know, as it relates to the having guns on campus, anytime any gun law goes in front of the General Assembly, the Virginia Association of Chiefs of Police, of which I sit on their executive board and their legislative chair as well, is we tend to not take positions unless we have very strong public safety concerns. So I won't take a position on whether I think that's a good or a bad idea. I would hope that, however, in deliberation, whatever deliberation would take place would be very thoughtful. You know, I found it interesting that the Supreme Court's only spoken five times on the Second Amendment in 221 years, five times on the Second Amendment, which is crucial, and twice just in the past 3 years. So any Second Amendment issue that comes in front of a court or a legislature is going to be very controversial, and my guess is most law enforcement officials are going to stay away from it.
Got a question back here. Let's see. Bert, Tom, can we get here, and then we'll catch you, Grace, and then over here.
Thanks, Tommy. Tim, a few years ago, I can't remember how long it was, we had a conference at the Omni with the Attorney General regarding gangs. Do you recall?
Vaguely, yes, sir.
Vaguely, okay. One of the issues at the time, as I recall, was what makes a gang a gang? Mm. What makes a gang and not a Boy Scout troop? would it be possible for you to address that at this time?
I'll let Steve address it as well, but I'll start by saying the Virginia Code sets out the criteria as to how a gang member would be validated. And part of the criteria is their involvement in predicate criminal acts. So if the group of individuals, two or more persons, come together for the purpose of conspiring in this criminal act, they could theoretically meet the definition of a criminal street gang. When we validate gang members, as I said before, the state code sets out certain criteria. Criminal history is one. Tattoos and self-admission to gangs is another validator or criteria that's used. You would be amazed, particularly when they're booked into to the regional jail, how many of them will admit to gang activity and association with a criminal street gang. Part of that is so they get housed and classified properly. And so that information is because the jail is part of our gang collaborative, the Charlottesville Area Gang Enforcement Unit. We get that information shared with us. So there is criteria set out in the code for how a gang member will be validated. But I often said that I don't care if we call them the Boy Scouts. As long as we agree that they've come together for an illegal purpose, and that purpose is to, in part, destroy the quality of life in our community, we can call them anything you want. Steve?
No, very good. I don't have anything to add. The crime is the key, you know, the criminal piece of it.
Over here with Grace.
In relation to this request in the legislature to allow professors to carry concealed guns and other laws and suggestions that concealed guns should be allowed in other places such as bars, etc. What I would like to know is, since self-defense is always given as the reason why this is so important, so how many crimes or how many times have guns been used in self-defense in your experience, both of you?
Well, the NRA actually keeps very good statistics on all that. I can tell you in my year here in Albemarle County, I can't think of a single one.
I can't either. I know back in Baltimore it was more frequent. You hear it more frequently than you do here, and it would typically involve homeowners. We're often asked sometimes about the issues of self-defense and if I were to do X, would Y result? And we're very cautious as to about giving that type of legal advice. But obviously the laws of justifications and defense would allow someone to protect themselves against imminent threats of death or serious bodily harm, and usually comes in that context. And my experience has been it's been the homeowner. But I can't recall of any situation in the recent past in the city of Charlottesville on the street where a person has used a firearm in defense of themselves against such imminent threats of death or serious bodily harm.
Over here, Tom, please. Then we'll get to you.
Hi. I wanted to echo the sentiment that you both of your departments are excellent. I live in Albemarle County, and I've had a number of occasions where the county police has responded beautifully and very tactfully. My question is very simple. We have a very committed neighborhood watch. It's not large, but there are a number of us who are involved, and I think more would be involved if we knew exactly how to help the police departments help us. Can you give us a little bit more on the specifics of that?
I got a quick question for her, Tom, in response to that. Are you connected with our crime prevention officer? Have they worked with you? Steve Watson? Okay. All right. That's your first door or window to answer that question. And I think there's a level of training that he is required to provide to the Neighborhood Watch to help answer those questions for your community. And that's my response. And perhaps, Tim, you have something else.
We don't have very many neighborhood watches that are active in the city. We have more neighborhood associations that are very strong and have strong relationships with the police department. And what we try to do with regard to them are two things. One, do the crime prevention presentations, whether it be personal protection or protection of your home, or hardening security features of your home, but then also to make sure that the officers who work that area where that neighborhood association is at least available on a monthly basis to be in attendance of those meetings, to bring crime statistics, to be able to respond to when trends are emerging, so that that neighborhood association, or in this case Neighborhood Watch, feels like there's a connection, not just to us. It's great to have a connection with us, but to have a connection, that police officer is going to respond to that call in your community regardless of what time of day it might be.
Well, one thing I want to do to take it to the next level a couple years from now, and it's in our strategic plan, we have 47 neighborhood watches in Alamo County right now, okay? And Steve Watson has recently been put into that job to restore neighborhood watches' strength and abilities and capabilities and numbers, okay? One of the things I want to be able to do in the future is create, to get more dialogue from the community, is to have each neighborhood watch throughout Alamo County select a representative to sit on a larger, sort of a large county group neighborhood watch, where I can get some honest feedback and we can talk about some tough issues like police pursuits and shootings and taser use and use of force, and I can get some feedback. But we got a couple of years to go before we get there.
Okay, we're going to go here, Tom, please, and then we'll go over here, and then I had a question someplace back here.
In terms of gangs, youth, and drugs, my question is, I'm not sure if the increase in gangs is related to outsiders coming in, specifically for purpose of selling drugs, and then also in terms of recruiting youth to do this. Related to that is the issue of the cutting of funding. I'm thinking in terms of schools and activities that would give kids beyond the regular school hours outlets for more positive activities, whether it's arts, sports, things like that. So how much is funding affecting your ability to deal with gangs, whether it's increase, whether it's outsiders coming in, but also my concern is young people getting sucked into gangs because they don't have more positive activities due to lack of funding.
Well, let me take the first one, and you can maybe take the second one.
Okay.
Yes, to a combination, your first question about where are they coming from and how are they recruiting and blah, blah, blah. Yes, they're coming from outside. We see gang members coming in from New York City, from New Jersey, from Richmond and Norfolk. And yes, there are local kids that are standing up and creating gangs that have no affiliation with any place outside this area. So it's a combination of both, which links back to your second question, you know, about the services. Our situation's a little different, Tim and I's, okay? Budgets do have some effect on this, but that can also be an excuse. I don't have any SROs in the middle schools anymore. They were cut from the budget, okay? Tim and I know that's prime location to recruit. So somehow or another, I got to be able to fill that gap. That is a budget question. But the services to kids, and I'm going to pass the buck to Tim here to answer this, it's not necessarily budget cuts, it's ownership. Tim?
Yeah, I had a really great conversation with Jim Pierce from the Boys and Girls Club last week, who was at the forum. It was actually a panel member with Steve and I at the forum that the Healthy Schools did with respect to gangs, and he has a tremendous interest in wanting to work directly with schools, understanding that there are budgetary constraints and there are resource issues where schools may not have the human resource or financial resource to be able to step up to the plate to deal with some of the after-school stuff. He's willing to say, look, tell me, educator, counselor, school resource officer, who the 12 or 15 kids are that I need to reach, because I have the resource, I have the building, I have the staff, I have the programming, I have the desire to meet that need. Just direct me, because I can't come into school and just know that's the kid I need to reach. I can't tell you how many times over the years we've had a big case and sent somebody to jail for a long time, and somebody will come up to me and say, "I could have told you that when they were at Buford. I could have told you that when they were Walker." And I think to myself, well, why didn't somebody do something? Why in the world are you telling me now? Here's a resource in our community, just one. I'm not just Boys and Girls Club, just one of many who's saying, just tell me who they are. Help me step up to the plate and meet the need, because I got the resource. And so he and I, and I believe Steve as well, because I sent him in your direction. I don't know if he's got there yet on this issue, but he wants to connect with whatever school resource officers are available in these schools and kind of collaborate with them to have a focused approach to reach the right group with the most need and bring them into the Boys and Girls Club and have those resources utilized.
Yep. See, I believe a lot of those resources are already here, okay? They're just not being coordinated.
Yeah. How much gang activity is there in this area? I mean, criminal activity. We hear a lot about gangs, but I've got no idea whether we're talking about tens or hundreds or how, you know, what sort of numbers are involved.
156 validated gang members, and that could be 157, but for all we know, tomorrow or last night.
And there could be more that have not yet been validated. My experience has been, and of course, Steve coming from Northern Virginia, me coming from Baltimore, hugely different environments that we're facing now. But most of these groups, the criminal activity they tend to form around is illicit drug sales most of the time. But some of the criminal activity you see the younger ones in aren't so much slinging rock on the street corner selling drugs, but the assaults that take place in areas where there's a lot of people, that they want to try to create that disruption. And, you know, I get concerned about it, you know, in our pedestrian mall, in our school division. Steve, I'm sure, gets concerned about it in the commercial shopping districts and the schools in his community. But we see some of that type of criminal behavior in the younger gang members. Mm-hmm. Does that seem accurate to you?
Yeah.
Over here?
Yes. Everybody talked about being afraid of guns and being shot. But isn't it true that stabbings and malicious beatings are equally as bad and dangerous?
Well, certainly, and I don't want to speak for Steve, but certainly are aggravated assaults by beating or by using some other object are significantly higher than someone being shot. So there's a greater likelihood that in an aggravated assault, it's more going to be a beating or use of some other type of instrument. When we use the term aggravated assault, and Steve's got his statistics up there, that simply means that the injury was such that it's an aggravated crime or a malicious wounding, or that there was an object used to carry out the assault, such as a bat or a knife or a stick or a brick or something of those lines.
Go ahead, please.
The other part is... we can protect ourselves, we think, you know, looking for gun. What can we do to prevent, like, a flash mob pulling a knife?
What can you do to prevent a flash mob?
Yeah, we've had flash mobs.
Yep. What are you looking at me for?
It's in the county, buddy.
We
I got Barracks Road.
There's two answers to that question, okay? One is sort of extra eyes and ears, which kind of comes from the crime prevention piece. If you see something that's out of ordinary or see something that's developing, call us so that we can get in front of it. The second thing is technology. Yes, we had a flash mob, okay? And we probably had a couple more that were stirred up. But we're getting smarter at technology and getting in front of these flash mobs before they occur. And that's a skill that we're developing over time and have gotten in front of some incidents by detecting it online before it occurred. Okay?
Can I ask a question to follow up? How useful have cameras been in the aftermath to help identify participants in flash mobs? Have you had any success with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Where are you going with this, Tim?
Cameras.
I know where you're going.
Seems to me they could be a useful tool in law enforcement.
Right.
I don't know. I'll leave that for someone else.
Right. Okay. We use these. Okay, we have time for one more question. We had one back here. Thank you.
Yes, in fact, it's got two parts, and it's really two separate questions, if I can sneak them in. First of all, can you describe your efforts to recruit and advance members of underrepresented minorities in your forces, your respective forces? And secondly, the police force at the university was brought up today, but I have no idea of its size, its scope, or its mission. If you could just give us a thumbnail on that, since we're running out of time.
I can talk about Alamance County's diversity and some of the cultural diversity within its ranks. It does not reflect the community as it should, I will tell you right now. I'm not happy with the current makeup and representations from a variety of cultures, from different language-speaking cultures, and from a diverse standpoint. And that is something that I have established as a priority for my recruitment section. So I can't articulate specific numbers. I can talk to you about gender. Gender, we're right on a national average, and most departments are, which is about 14% women. We're around there right now.
What about the size of the UVA force?
Yeah, the UVA is probably including their, they're probably 50 to 60 sworn police officers, and then their security personnel that you see in the hospital. I think they wear gray uniforms. There's, I don't know, maybe 30 or 40 of them. So they're about 100 staff, but only about 50 or 60 are sworn law enforcement officers. But they are a bona fide law enforcement agency. Those officers receive the same training that our officers received. It's just that their territorial jurisdiction is the grounds of the University of Virginia. Good. We do have collaborative agreements with them and mutual aid agreements. As far as our diversity plan is, we work a diversity plan through our City Human Resources Department. We recruit in minority job fairs. We try to target educational institutions that have high minority populations and a criminal justice program to see if we can kind of successfully recruit that way. We also run publications in newspapers and other types of publications that reach diverse communities as well in an effort to recruit a diverse workforce, in addition to try to reach out to the community to say, you know where our shortcomings are. Shortcomings in African-American representation, and there's shortcomings in Latino representation. So you can help us by directing young men and women to the field of law enforcement that are of African-American descent and also Latino descent as well.
Well, before we conclude with thanking these fine gentlemen, I want to remind people, I'm Jim Perkins on the board of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia on behalf of Sue Liberman, who is on a well-earned vacation today and asked me to stand in. I want to remind you that next month, Wednesday, February the 8th, we're having Dahlia Lithwick, a senior editor at Slate and editor at Newsweek, and a contributor to the New York Times Magazine, who's going to talk on the Supreme Court. The following month, we're going to have our own Craig Littlepage, our own from the University of Virginia. He's the athletics director, and he's going to be speaking on big-time collegiate athletics and the interface with academics, especially at UVA. That's March 14th. Again, I want to thank you gentlemen, Tim Longo, Steve Sellers, for a fine presentation and representation and what you're doing for our community. And thank you for taking the time to do that for us today.
Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.